for the Natural Resources Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Thursday, April 21st, 2005. And the first thing we're going to do is invite the Treasurer's Office to come forward and talk to the committee about the management of the Common School Fund. This is an issue, committee members, that you'll remember came up during the presentation around the Department of State Lands. And we had questions about how the trust fund was administered and the returns of the trust fund compared to other investments that the state makes. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us today.
Chair Morgan, thank you, committee members. For the record, my name is Ron Schmitz, Director of the Investment Division. Our intelligence indicated that there were also some broader questions, and not just related to Common School Fund. If that's incorrect, I can shut up and turn it over to Mike. But I was going to provide just a real brief overview of the various portfolios that we manage and just give you a quick snapshot of Treasury activity. But if you're really interested primarily or only in the Common School Fund and some of the details there, Mike Mueller has a detailed presentation about policies and procedures.
I do think that we would benefit from getting a broad overview before we dive into the Common School Fund.
Great. Then of the two packets you have, I'll talk very briefly on the first one, the smaller of the two. On the first page, as it indicates, the Investment Division of the Treasurer's Office manages various asset pools totaling over $60 billion, the lion's share of which is accounted for by the pension assets, OPERF, or the PERS portfolio at $48 billion, but also manage funds for SAFE, the Common School Fund, Oregon Short-Term Fund, and the Oregon Growth Account. Treasury is staffed to various governing boards that determine the policies and procedures that these various portfolios operate under. The Oregon Investment Council is by far the most prominent of those. They handle the pension portfolio, the SAFE assets, as well as the Common School Fund. The Oregon Investment Council, along with the Short-Term Fund Board, work on the Short-Term Fund portfolio governance, and then the Oregon Growth Account Board is separate for that small portfolio. The Short-Term Fund is a single asset class portfolio, money market instruments for state agencies and local municipalities, local governments, and the like. The Oregon Growth Account, for those that don't know, is a small Oregon-oriented venture capital portfolio that's funded by lottery money and used to generate returns that way. Pension portfolio, the SAFE assets, and Common School Fund are broad multi-asset class portfolios. If you flip to the second page, there's a rather complicated, and I apologize for that, but a rather busy organization chart. If I could just real briefly walk through that, I won't spend a lot of time, I promise. But this is a schematic of the OPERF portfolio and its management. And the reason that I have that here is it's really a template for the other portfolios we manage. The others are really a subset of this portfolio in a manner of speaking.
The assets are actually included, so.
Okay, good. Yeah, the $60 billion does include all of those assets. But just for orientation purposes, the yellow boxes represent staff, Treasury staff. As I mentioned, I'm the director of the division, sort of the master or jack of all trades, master of none. As you go down the bottom of the pyramid, you get the real experts, the asset class specialists that deal day-to-day with the nitty-gritty of their various portfolios, the strategies and the managers and brokers and all of that. The red or hot pink or whatever you'd call that color it represents the consultants to the Oregon Investment Council. Staff works with those consultants, but I would stress that those consultants are consultants to the council and not to staff. So it gives an independent set of eyes and a third party, if you will, look at the things that we're doing. The gray box represents custodian relationship with State Street Bank, and then the white boxes are the various relationships, primarily with managers, brokers, etc. So again, just it is a complicated portfolio, the pension portfolio. The other portfolios we manage are a little simpler, but this, in kind of one snapshot, really lays the groundwork for everything else for the other portfolios that we run. You have, I think, the next page is a series of pie charts, I think six. Basically, what that shows is for the multiple asset portfolios, PERS, SAFE, and the Common School Fund, just gives the asset allocation targets and actual at the point in time that was run. And you can see that each portfolio has a unique footprint. The pension portfolio is, as I mentioned earlier, the largest. It is by far the most complicated. It has more asset classes, more multiple segments within asset class and multiple managers. The SAFE portfolio is a very conservative portfolio given insurance industry regulation, capital risk requirements, and so forth. It's primarily bond-oriented. And you can see that there, both the policy targets as well as the actual. The Common School Fund, which Mike will be talking about in more detail, has a risk-reward profile that's relatively similar to PERS in terms of its equity exposure and its risk profile, but it is actually managed when you get down to the strategies within the asset classes quite differently. It does not use real estate and private equity as the PERS portfolio does, and there are some reasons for that Michael will walk through in his presentation. The last page, then, that what I have for you starts with performance numbers for the three portfolios that involve multiple asset classes. I'm happy to say that in all but one of those time periods for all three portfolios, the actual portfolio has outperformed its benchmark. And that benchmark is an independently derived benchmark blessed by the independent consultants. SAFE missed the five-year number, and there are a variety of reasons for that. I don't think which necessarily we need to go into now, but there were some systematic and strategic issues going on a few years back that kind of drive that. But we're very pleased that over the 1, 3, and 5-year periods, the portfolios in general have performed quite well. The one last comment I would make as a setup to Mike is that asset mix is really what determines 85% to 90% of the returns of any portfolio. Various academic studies have shown that out. And that's why you see, while they're different, the returns of OPERF and the Common School Fund are reasonably similar, whereas the returns in the SAFE portfolio, which is primarily bond-oriented, can be quite different, particularly over short periods of time. The other 10 to 15% that drives the differences in one portfolio's performance over the other has to do with the strategies within the asset classes and the managers selected. And both of those pieces are part of the answer behind why the returns from portfolio to portfolio are a little bit different. So unless there are some kind of broad general questions, I'd like to turn it over to Mike to walk you through some very specific discussion of the Common School Fund.
So if we had questions about why the rates of return of the Common School Fund compared to the other two funds in the five-year category are so low, who would answer those best?
Well, we probably both can, but let me take a first stab at it since I'm on a roll here. The biggest difference, I think, has to do with, as I mentioned, asset mix. The real estate and private equity asset classes that are in the pension portfolio but are not in the Common School Fund have performed quite well over that period of time, and particularly private equity, even during the bear market years, as you look back, the private equity portfolio has performed quite well, and that would be the primary difference.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I'm Mike Mueller, the Assistant Director of Investments. What I'd like to add is that these portfolios do not have the same investment objective. They're quite different. Obviously, for the pension fund, we're trying to fund a pension obligation for the long run. And for the Common School Fund, our goal is to meet the distribution requirements that have been set by the State Land Board while preserving the purchasing power of the underlying fund. And for the SAFE portfolio, obviously it's an insurance business, and they have capital requirements, again, with distinctly unique requirements. So the objective of these three portfolios are all unique, and therefore it wouldn't be appropriate to compare returns across these funds.
Well, so I assume you're going to take us deeper down into the strategy behind the Common School Fund.
Correct.
So let's go there and see what shakes out from that discussion.
I apologize. I noticed after I printed this that I failed to put page numbers on here. But if you'll flip to the first page, that covers the agenda. And if there's anything on there that doesn't appear to be of interest to this committee, let me know, and I'll be happy to skip over it. My plan is to go through this fairly quickly, and then we can come back and address any specific questions that you may have. Obviously, the background on the Common School Fund, I think, is familiar to this group. The Act of Congress admitting Oregon to the Union granted Sections 16 and 36 for the use of schools. What's important about that is the assets that we manage within this portfolio are managed exclusively. Our fiduciary duty is to the beneficiaries of the Common School Fund, which is, in our minds, K through 12 education. So we manage it to that, with that goal in mind.
Sure.
Representative Shockley.
The various circumstances, there's only X amount left, 772,000 acres. I had 2 years ago in the Water Committee, they talked about a scandal that happened like 75 or 100 years ago. Can you get that to me? I'd like to read the details of that. Some legislators were put in the prison. And forgive me, I have some specific questions later to what we're doing.
The state archives could probably provide you with more stuff than
great.
You could
possibly want.
Yes.
The various circumstances I'm interested in. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Morgan, Representative Schauffler, if you'll turn to the next page, oversight of the fund, I'm going to try to deflect that responsibility that you just tried to put on me. In terms of the oversight of the fund, the Division of State Lands is responsible for the management of the land assets. We are simply a beneficiary of the receipts of that land management, and that is the right side there is the graph for which the Oregon Investment Council and the State Treasurer is responsible for investing. So that's kind of the delineation of responsibility. We take from the land board the distribution policy. They set the distribution policy. That's one of the considerations that we take into account when we do our asset liability study in terms of what are we trying to achieve with these investments now that we have this distribution requirement put upon us.
I have a question about distribution, Madam Chair, please. You know, you got all this money here, and I know most of this is tied up, dedicated. And I don't even know if the times we're going through right now would even justify dipping into any of this. But the $900 million, I've heard that around a lot. How hard would it be? I know state legislation, you can do anything, but how difficult would it be if the law was there in real dire times to fund schools to liquidate and get that money to go in a different direction if you wanted to chip into that? That's a big question, and maybe you don't want to answer that one either. But
no. Chair Morgan, Representative Schauffler, we look at the fund in perpetuity, so it's not simply for the current generation of K-12, but future generations as well. And our goal in meeting the funding requirement is to meet the distribution requirements set by the land board, which is a maximum of 5%, which is reasonable, we think, because we have to earn in addition to that to keep pace with inflation. So to preserve the purchasing power of the corpus for future generations, we think that the current distribution policy is fairly prudent.
Please proceed.
The tab there, tab two, heading two that says distribution policy and alternatives. This is the current policy of the land board. If you just continue to flip through, there's a chart there that shows the growth of the fund. Representative Schauffler mentioned the fact that we're at $900 million presently, so I'll just skip over that. So the distribution policy of the land board is to achieve a balance between current distribution and growing the corpus or preserving the purchasing power of the corpus, which is what this spending rule tries to accomplish. We worked with our consultant and modeled alternative spending policies, which are on the next page, to see what the impact may be over time in terms of perhaps increasing the distributions to schools currently and what that might do to the corpus of the fund over time. So the next page just gives you a list of the alternative spending policies that we considered.
What does smoothing mean?
Smoothing means presently the distribution policy simply takes the value at the end of each calendar year and we say how much did that change, and then we apply the spending rule. A smoothing would take 3 years of history and do it over a longer time period to smooth out the fluctuations that you may get from year to year.
So the appropriation would go up more slowly and down more slowly using that scenario.
Chair Morgan, that's correct. And we find that if you treat the fund like an endowment, which is how I like to look at it, typically most endowment funds use if you turn to the next slide, which is a survey of endowment distribution policies, almost 83%, according to this survey, spend a pre-specified percentage of a moving average of the market values.
Still answering that question. I just wanted to ask, is that smoothing term exactly the same way it's used in PERS as well? Is that the same activity there?
Representative Schauffler, the concept is the same. It may have slightly different mechanics from one to the other, but it's the same concept.
Yeah, and I would add that there's a connotation with the accounting treatment of smoothing that when you're talking of a pension fund, that is not applicable here. This is merely a means to smooth the distributions, not which is dissimilar from what's happening when you're talking about the accounting smoothing of a pension fund.
I'm not sure that from our perspective it would have that big much of an impact one way or the other. What's your feeling about that?
Madam Chair, I think it still would be affected by wide swings. Am I correct in assuming that? I mean, even with a smoothing policy, if you have this kind of thing in a fund, you're going to have some swings in the distribution.
You'd just be taking the tops off the mountains and the bottoms off of the valleys a little bit.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I could just ask Mike to clarify something. I thought I heard you say that the current policy is just the year-end value compared to the prior year-end value. I thought the land board recently changed their policy, not for this last December 31st calculation, but in the future, and that would first affect the 06-07 distribution. I'm seeing Pamela nod her head. So I believe now the current policy does include smoothing. Is that correct? Okay. This way.
Please proceed.
The next slide is a summary of the Common School Fund historical distributions. This is from the Department of State Lands website. The 2005, this is a cash basis, so I've only included what's been paid out. There's a distribution coming in June that will bump that 2005 column a little bit north of $40 million. The next bit I'd like to talk about is the asset allocation process that we go through with our consultant and with the Oregon Investment Council to really understand how to invest the assets of the Common School Fund to achieve our desired goals. And the main thing here is to balance the creative tension between the current beneficiaries and future generations and picking that asset allocation that has the best likelihood of achieving the desired outcome. And the last time we undertook this was in December of 2002, and typically this is a 3 to 5 year process that you would undertake. It's not something that you do annually to move your strategic asset allocation. The next slide simply emphasizes what I talked about earlier, which is the required return is meet our spending requirements for the current beneficiaries and then keep pace with inflation. And try to maximize the spending amount while creating stability within the portfolio. And these are sometimes goals that can be at odds with each other, so it's a balancing act that we undertake. The components of the process are, if you look at those three balls on the left side, the circumstances, goals and preferences, and the capital markets, the first one just really sets the stage. The goals and preferences force us to identify what are we trying to get at from this portfolio. And lastly, the capital markets is what can we do within the investment universe that's out there to achieve the ends that we need to with a minimum level of risk.
Let me just interject a question, and this may not be the time that you answer it, but I'm going back to the return on investments in this slide, and I'm looking at the Common School Fund, which, you know, you're making a distribution out of it on every year, and you're trying, I would assume, to get the highest distribution or the highest amount of money for that distribution. I'm curious, given the way that the components of the process is set up, what leads you to make decisions that make the returns on the PERS investment higher than the returns on the Common School Fund?
Again, Chair Morgan, they have different goals. One is to fund a defined benefit obligation, and the other is to meet the spending requirements of the Common School Fund. And they're not necessarily the same. So we wouldn't implement the same asset allocation strategy. Those pie charts that Ron showed you, the portfolio for PERS, while overall has several of the same asset classes that we implement for the Common School Fund, given the size and scope of the pension fund, there are things that we can do in a cost-effective manner that may not always be applicable to the Common School Fund, and we don't necessarily need to move into those asset classes to achieve the goals of this fund.
So is one of the factors the relative difference in size between the PERS funds and the common school funds?
Chair Morgan, that is one. And the other consideration is how much risk are you willing to take to achieve the funding that you're trying to obtain? I would wager to say that the PERS portfolio has a slightly different risk profile than the common school fund. And risk and return are intertwined. And what we looked at is what is the minimum level of risk that we need to take with this common school fund portfolio to meet the spending requirements of the fund, not necessarily what is the highest return that we can achieve, because if we try to achieve the highest return, we increase the volatility of the portfolio and likewise will increase the likelihood of falling short of our goal too. And I have some charts later that will show the range of possible outcomes. Typically we talk about the median or the mean, the most likely outcome, which is what we hope we get, but certainly at the ends of any distribution you can fall in either the highly favorable or not so favorable end of the spectrum as well, because we're taking a look into the future and nobody knows what the future holds when it comes to investment returns.
Let's keep going.
Okay. The chart that says why is this important, what is the goal, Ron mentioned this briefly, but I will highlight it again since it's at the heart of what we're talking about, which is asset allocation. And academics through studies have demonstrated that asset allocation explains about 90% of the return volatility of a portfolio and 90 to 100% of the returns if they're actively managed. Again, just to echo what Ron said before. I will skip over the next slide that talks about the six questions that we're trying to answer. How do we measure success? The main factor is to build consensus with the Oregon Investment Council. That is that they understand the assumptions that underlie this portfolio and why we're doing what we're doing, and they have buy-in, and that the rationale for the selection is clear. And the other thing that it instills is discipline. That is that we can maintain this asset allocation through both good and bad times, because often when markets turn down is the time when people try to do things in a tactical nature that may be the worst time to do that. So we try to set these strategic targets and stay true to them through both good and bad times, because over the long run, again, it's been demonstrated that that's the way to do successful investing and not to try to outsmart yourself or the market. The next couple slides merely highlight the assumptions that went into it. We revisit these assumptions annually, although we only change them on a 3 to 5 year period, again, these strategic assumptions. So I've laid out the table for you of the capital market assumptions. These are academics, economists, and consultants who survey the landscape and do a best estimate for what they think the capital markets will bring us over the next 10 years. And again, it's largely based on historical performance and some intuition and some guesswork, quite honestly, since we really don't know what the markets are going to bring. So these are point estimates with a range generally built around them. But we need some input into our models to come up with the asset allocation. So what we studied in the next slide, alternative asset allocation mixes examined. The primary determinant here is we vary the amount of equities that go into the portfolio to see how it improves or doesn't our ability to meet the goals of the fund. Jumping ahead to the conclusions of that study, there's a chart that says cumulative nominal return, 10-year annualized. It's kind of a busy pie chart, but it gets at the heart of this point estimation that I'm talking about. If you'll just focus on that middle chart or the middle bar alone, that's the current asset allocation policy. Is everybody on that page? Because this is kind of the crux of the matter. What we find is that return will get us a median return of 7.8%, but I want to point out for you the range that's involved because of the high allocation to equities. According to this study, if you consider it a normal distribution, we could do as well as 30.7% on an annual basis. That's at the 5% extreme. And likewise, we could look at 10 years of minus 10% returns. Again, that's at the other extreme. We don't expect that to happen, but that's certainly within the realm of probability given the point estimates and the assumptions that go into these models.
Representative Schaffner.
What does this mean in dollars? 7.7%. How
okay.
Much money is that?
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffner, we'll turn the page.
Good leading question.
Thank you.
This shows you what it means in terms of nominal dollars, and I talked about earlier the importance of maintaining the purchasing power of the fund. This doesn't tell us if we've done that, but over 10 years it says you could assume, based on your current spending policies and the assumptions of asset returns, that the portfolio will grow to, again, if we got all of this exactly right, about $1.2 billion. And then you can see the range there for yourself of the likely outcomes. The next page is inflation adjusted. This is kind of the proof statement, if you will. Have we preserved the purchasing power of the fund? And again, it's right around $900 million, $985 million. So that goal would be achieved. But again, there are downside and upside possibilities that we need to be cognizant of when we do this kind of work. And then the last slide says cumulative spending after 10 years. If we maintain the purchasing power of the fund, how much will we be able to distribute over that 10-year period? And you see point estimates at the 5% range from a low of $199 million to a high of approximately $490 million. Again, those are extreme numbers, and I would expect that we'd be somewhere between the top and bottom quartile range, somewhere in there. So somewhere between 258 and 375 million total distributions over a 10-year period if we want to maintain the purchasing power of the fund. If you'll skip ahead a few slides to move this along, how the fund looks today. I have a summary of the key Oregon Investment Council beliefs. We talked a little bit about the difference of investing the pension fund versus this fund. We're able to meet our return objectives for this fund by a fairly simple asset allocation of 50% in domestic equity that is passively managed by one of our large passive index managers for an incredibly low fee, I might add. And likewise on the international side, 20%. It's a passively managed portfolio, again, with very favorable management fees. Where we take some active risk is in the bond portfolio, the other 30%. We have two active managers that manage the bond portfolio for us and have done quite well over the last several years, and we'll look at performance numbers in the last slide. Point number four, the last point on the second page of the summary of key OIC beliefs is why don't we invest in some other asset classes to try to get some return like we do in the pension fund? And the answer to that question is to meet the funding requirements of this portfolio, it wasn't necessary to include those asset classes in the mix. The last couple slides point out that the current asset allocation policy, which we've gone over, I just broke down the numbers for you.
Can I get you to back up just one time?
Sure.
The private equity and real estate assets, are they... are the returns more volatile there than in the domestic and international equities and the bond market?
Sure, Chair Morgan, they indeed would be more volatile, particularly on an annual basis, but even over 3 and 5 year periods, they tend to be more volatile.
So that's the primary reason from excluding them in this case, because in order to make the returns that you need to make, you don't need to add those two classes?
Primary. I struggle a little with that. It is certainly a key factor. I don't know if I would call it primary. Mike alluded to size being an impact as well. Those are asset classes that don't readily make themselves available to small portfolios. So the size of the common school fund, I think, is a factor as well. It's just not as practical to do those illiquid private market transactions for a small portfolio.
So why wouldn't you choose to do something like blend all this money into one big pot for investment purposes and then factor it back out for reporting purposes?
Chair Morgan, I don't believe we can legally do that. They're separate trusts.
Kate's giving me the high sign in the background there.
And Chair Morgan, I would also add that for the reasons I cited earlier, you may not want to do that. For the same reason, if you, in your personal life, you may have a retirement portfolio that you manage one way, and you may have a college savings account that you're managing for your children another way, and they may not have the same investment goals. If you'll, there's a, to your point, there's a slide I included that's a little bit dated but still accurate. It says common school fund versus asset mixes. It's near the end of my presentation. It's from a National Association of Endowment Funds. And what you see is that in terms of domestic equities, if you have the color chart, the blue is the common school fund. Our allocation to fixed income and equities is fairly consistent with those other funds. Where we don't have exposure to, say, a large endowment like a Harvard, a Stanford, or a Yale, is in the more illiquid markets of private equity, hedge funds, and real estate that we talked about before. But I might add that if you turn to the next slide, the last one, which is how has the fund performed, I guess surprisingly the fund performed quite well last year relative to even those large endowment funds. There's a typo on here. The period ended is not in the future. It is December 2004, so I apologize for that error. But again, we measure our performance versus what we call a policy benchmark. The policy benchmark is simply if we invested our assets entirely passively, that would be our expected rate of return. That would be the lowest risk portfolio, lowest cost portfolio, I should say. And because we've added active management in the fixed income area, we expect to do slightly better than that. And in fact, we have over all these investment periods, we've been able to add some value over that passive benchmark. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any additional questions that you may have.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you. Mary, you mentioned college fund for her children. My wife and I consistently monthly put money and add on to that. Sometimes when we have extra money into our daughter's college education fund. But we still have control of that. So if there was an emergency, we'd take that money out and spend it on her. If our roof was leaking, we wouldn't, fortunately, have the resources not to do that. But if we were a family that did, we'd fix our roof. This fund, as it grows, and Ms. Hannis wants to double it, which I hope she does. I hope she triples it. How big are we going to let it get, and then something hits the fan, and we just let it sit there and not fix our roof? That's a rhetorical question, Madam Chair. But you know, we're struggling here for pennies.
Has not been left undiscussed over the last 3 years.
Right.
I might
add. Well, now I'm here bugging you with it again, I guess. But have there been any discussions in the department where it's X billion now, if it's X times two, then we could be able to, as money comes in bad times only, fill in where we need due to loss of general fund money. You guys and gals talk about that, or is it just the prudent 5% all the time? Is that etched in stone, never to be changed?
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaufler, it's not etched in stone. Again, we take our cue from the land board in terms of what they would like to do. We will certainly provide our input and what we think is prudent. But what will happen is, just in your example, which is a good one, if you take money out now to repair your roof, and I'll use my daughter as an example since I know the timeline. She's going to be entering college hopefully in 10 years. If I repair my roof today, I probably won't have the funds necessary to fund her education when she goes to college in 10 years. And likewise, if we dip into this fund for when times are tough, so to speak, that's to the detriment of future generations and our ability to meet the spending obligations in the future. So I think what we've done here is laid out, and hopefully the numbers that shows that we've preserved the real purchasing power of the fund lends credence to that argument that we aren't really growing it, doubling it, in terms of the real spending power of that money.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson, did you have any comments or questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We now open a public hearing on House Bills 5003 and 5004. 5003 is the budget bill for the Department of Agriculture. 5004 is a fee bill for the department. And we will call the department forward and the BAM analyst forward. And let's proceed with Mr. Siebert setting the stage for us if he feels that that would benefit us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have the Department of Agriculture before you. I believe they're going to start with discussions about the response to the prioritized list and then move into discussions about the performance measures.
Thank you. Ms. Koba, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. We wanted to start out, first of all, I think you have a pile of paper on your desk, once again, thanks to the forest products industry. And in that pile, there is copies of all the questions that we had provided answers for to the committee already. We have one question that we're going to, that we didn't get to you and would like to provide now. And that was, I believe, Chair Morgan's question about who are our partners in implementing the Agriculture Water Quality Management Program? And so that handout is coming around, and let me just go through the highlight it real quickly, and then if you've got further questions, we can try to answer those. We have a number of partners, I guess, bottom line. At the local level, our key partner are our soil and water conservation districts, of which there are 45 around the state. And we work very closely with them, and they are really the kind of the key implementers in putting projects on the ground for agricultural water quality improvements. At the state level, obviously, probably our primary partner is the Department of Environmental Quality and the relationship there in terms of water quality and preventing water pollution in the state. We also work with Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. We are the primary implementers of the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, which is a federal program that monies come to OWEB, and then we have worked very closely with them to do a lot of work with the CREP program. And other state partners include Department of Fish and Wildlife, Water Resources, Division of State Lands, now Department of State Lands, I guess, and Oregon State University Extension. We work very closely with them as well in terms of outreach to landowners. At the federal level, a key partner is the U.S. Department of Ag's Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Farm Service Agency. And again, both in terms of technical assistance as well as sources of funding. And other federal partners include EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, NOAA Fisheries, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So that's a real quick run-through of the answer. And then you had also asked how much is being spent on implementation, and so we attached a spreadsheet of the funds that we have in our agency that go to implementation programs. They're basically divided into three programs: our agriculture water quality implementation of Senate Bill 1010, our confined animal feeding operation program, and then the soil and water conservation districts. And we have two positions within our agency that oversee the soil and water districts, and then a grants manager to the soil and water districts. And then you can see there's a lot of special payments money that comes through our agency to the soil and water districts for technical assistance, projects on the ground, administration. So we tried to display that in a format that would be understandable for the committee. Okay. With that, we would like to shift to performance measures. So I'm going to have Lisa come up as well in case there are questions that I can't answer. And in your pile, you should have a document that says, it's a one-pager front and back that says Oregon Department of Agriculture 2005 Performance Measures Following Phase 1. And again, if you'll remember from our phase one, we had a number of categories under performance measures, and we tried to once again summarize those. On this piece of paper, we have separated into those performance measures that we are proposing to keep, those performance measures that we are adding as new. So on the front page, if the committee was to agree with all of this, this would be our list of performance measures from this point forward that would come through the Ways and Means process. Then on the back, a list of secondary measures, and these are measures that we've had that we're proposing to move and just keep this information internal. It's information that's important to us in running our programs, but not necessarily important to you. And then finally, a list of four measures that we propose to delete altogether. Now what I'd like to go back to is those that are bolded, and those are the ones where we still had questions and we had agreed to come back to the committee to address those. The first one under the keep column would be 603-6, and this is the performance measure for our animal feed program, and I believe that it was Senator Bates that had a question. We had proposed to move this to be a secondary measure, and I think he was concerned about whether this program and our animal feed program is a key element, particularly in preventing ruminant-to-ruminant feed, which is known as the cause for BSE. In going back and reviewing this program, we are still recommending that this move to a secondary performance measure. We had 115 violations in our animal feed program last year. Only one was really somewhat connected to a health problem, and that was an antibiotic found in the feed that should not have been there. But all the other violations are really protein content as not as claimed on the label, or other kinds of content not on the label. So it's really more of a label violation.
No connection to animal health or human health?
No, Madam Chair. Okay. 603-7, this was a measure that we had, which the measure as it currently reads is the number of top 10 out of the top 100 list of plant pest diseases or weed species that are successfully excluded from the state each year. And the committee felt that wasn't as good a measure as maybe we could have. So our proposed revised wording for that measure would be the number of plant pest diseases and weeds on the state's 100 most dangerous list that we successfully exclude or contain in the state. So it gives, a bigger picture of what it is that we're dealing with in terms of invasive pests, diseases, those kinds of things.
I think it defines the field, too, which mm-hmm. is very helpful to us.
Measure 603-8. This is also an existing measure that we have, and you were curious to see if we couldn't come up with a better measure. The current measure says the percentage of Oregon counties with target pests and weeds present where biological control agents are established. I think the committee viewed this more as just kind of a number exercise. Our suggested change would read the percentage of biological controls that are released, which are then successfully controlling pests and weeds. So it's a better measure of how successful the biological controls are that we release out in the state. Right now, just so you get a sense of that, the number of sites where we have biologicals that are working would be 524, and the total number of biological control sites where we've attempted to introduce a biological control agent is 1,619. So you can see we're right at about 30% in terms of successful work with these biological control agents. So that's what the measure would look like, and we would set a target for that. Okay, moving down under the new measures, we wanted to highlight the customer service performance measure. Our understanding is there is going to be a standardized measure for all agencies, so we'll obviously use that standardized measure as opposed to the one that we had originally proposed.
Okay.
Then 603-32, if you'll remember, if you look on the backside, highlighted under the secondary measure is 603-14, and under the deleted measure, 603-15. This was an attempt to measure the performance of our water quality program, and we were using soil and say it three times fast. Soil and real erosion rates, and that you were wondering if there wasn't a better measure. So under 60332, at the bottom of the first page, we have two things to toss out to you to see what you might like the best. The first one option would be the percent of monitored stream reaches in those areas that are predominantly agricultural use, with A, significantly increasing trends in riparian vegetative cover, B, riparian vegetative cover in good to excellent conditions, and C, decreasing trends in riparian vegetative coverage. So as you can see, riparian vegetative coverage, we think, is a very important part of improving ag water quality, so this measure would target where that is indeed happening. The other option that we offer for you, instead of looking at riparian vegetative cover, would be to use, again, those stream sites with predominantly agricultural use that have A, significantly increasing trends in water quality, B, water quality in good to excellent condition, or C, decreasing trends in water quality. And the data we would use here would be data that DEQ collects within streams. So we would take that information that's collected in those streams that have predominantly agricultural use and use that data to plug into this measure. So we're looking at vegetative cover versus...
And my feeling is that, well, there is a lot of controversy over the importance of vegetative cover and the impact that it's going to have on predominantly temperature, and that there are other issues here other than temperature that 1010 needs to get its hands around. There's issues about erosion, issues around effluent going into the water bodies, temperature issues, of course. So my personal preference would be the second one here. I think that that would much more globally reflect the information that the committee would need to have in order to figure out whether the 1010 plans were accomplishing their goals. Representative Shoffman.
I'm going to ask a very layman's term question here. Sheet and rill erosion, and then you have soil or rill erosion. You're going to tell me
problems with that in the first
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, you do have material in your answers that talks all about that fascinating topic.
Thank you very much.
And I would invite you to read that this evening, and then we could have a conversation about that in much more detail.
All right, look forward to
that. That means I need to read it, too.
All right. Well, I want to make more work. Thank you very much.
So would you are you proposing a performance measure that would display all three of those aspects?
We're looking at someone who knows, Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan, I believe it is. For the record, Lisa Hansen, Assistant Director with the Department of Agriculture.
Thank you.
The measure would look at all three aspects, and it would take those sites that are monitored by DEQ, and I believe there's about 18 of them that we would be able to use.
I think that the second part of this would work very well for our purposes.
Okay. Moving down to the secondary measures, we wanted to make sure we talked again about measure 6034. I think we were not clear from the committee's deliberations the first time around. We had proposed moving this to a secondary measure, and we wanted to make sure that's the committee was in agreement to that. There was some discussion about keeping that as a primary measure, so we just wanted to make sure we clearly understood the committee's desire.
To keep it as a primary measure. I am going to make the determination that we'll keep it as a secondary measure, and if Senator Bates has burning issues, we can revisit this in the third part of this process.
Okay, thank you. We talked about 60314. 60310, the last one under the secondary list, there was a discussion in committee, even though we're keeping this as secondary. I think, Madam Chair, it was your interest in seeing if there wasn't a better measure talking about our threatened endangered plant program. So the measure we currently have is number of plant species either delisted in Oregon as a result of species recovery work, and we're suggesting that we measure the percent of listed species where state recovery work has successfully halted declines or resulted in population increases of that plant. So because of our work, we're keeping the plant either steady or actually increasing the population of the plant.
Would it be difficult to add another aspect to this where there was a measure of species that were not listed because of work that the department did?
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Assistant Director with the Department of Ag. Joe Morgan, we had significant discussion around that in the department, and that was very difficult for us to get to. And our staff doing the work were uncomfortable with how fuzzy it was in terms of being able to get their hands around it and the real effect.
And I'm curious about why that was fuzzy. I mean, what I'm kind of thinking of in my mind here is quite often there are requests by various parties to have things listed for one reason or another. Then we ask the agencies to do some data gathering or put some measures in place that either point out that there is no need to list because of the work that's been done by the agencies, or the mitigation efforts that are proposed are sufficient to satisfy the people that want to list that there's no reason to list. Why can't those things be measured?
Madam Chair, I think maybe we're interpreting it two different ways. I think if there's a request that comes to the department and we make a judgment about whether it needs to be listed or not, that is something that we could measure. I think maybe we were interpreting trying to figure out how many potential species were out there that could be listed.
I'm more interested in actual things rather than just the whole universe.
So I think we could come back with a proposal that would be something along the lines of percent of requests to list a species received by the department that were not necessary to list or something like that.
I should have framed that more clearly, but that was the question that I was asking.
I think we can do that. The only other measure that we highlighted under the proposed delete measures, just because there's a lot of interest, obviously, around the pesticide use reporting system, it's a measure we've proposed to delete because the system is not funded at this point in time. I assume if it's funded, that may be a measure that we would put back on our list.
Just hold that one off in the old holding corral here and see what happens.
Let's see, what is this?
What I do today, what we can do tomorrow.
The one other. Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on.
Let's move on.
Real quickly, I wanted to touch base on the committee's prioritized list for our programs. Just wanted to touch base on a couple of those, and I think, Paul, does the committee have the list?
Madam Chairman of the committee, it was attached to the information we provided your offices a few days before the hearing.
I can speak real briefly to it. It's pretty easy. I don't think you need the list in front of you, but The committee chose to move the shellfish program up fairly high on the prioritized list, and I think the thinking behind that was, again, a food safety kind of a program. I'm not proposing that ranking be changed. I just wanted to highlight that our shellfish program, when you compare that to our food safety program, touches a much, much smaller percentage of Oregonians, so it certainly isn't on the magnitude in terms of protecting consumer public health as our food safety program. I just wanted to clarify that. The other one I wanted to point out, and that's the weeds program. And the weeds program on our list had been prioritized as number 15, and the committee moved that down to number 24. And as I understood the committee, they kind of lumped that program into some of our other natural resources regulatory programs and had ranked those a little bit lower. We actually view the weed program as equally, if not more, influential under the economic health of the industry program, because invasive weeds can cause real economic damage if we don't either keep them out or figure out a way to control them. So, again, not recommending necessarily a change, but wanted to bring that to the committee's attention, again, in terms of our thinking around the weeds program.
The biodiesel or fuel bills that are going through, we're talking about weeds as being invasive, and what the director is saying is that there is a big issue there.
Let's make note of these, and then in the third part of this we'll have a discussion around the agency's feedback to us.
So with that, I think we're ready to move into the governor's recommended budget, so I will turn it over to Christina to give her overview.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Christina Shear, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. Paul's passing out the DAS BAM presentation. You've all seen the format before. Katie, I'm sorry. Again, as has been my habit with this committee, I will move very quickly unless you have questions. Feel free to stop me. I know this format is familiar to you, so I'm not going to bore you with details you've already seen. On page 2 of the presentation is the natural resource needs.
Contagious!
The natural resources program area pie charts. You'll notice that the Department of Agriculture on the all funds chart, it represents approximately 5% of the total funds in this program area. And under the general fund lottery fund portion of the pie chart, it's approximately 9%. A good deal of that is lottery, as well as there's a good mix of lottery and general fund in there. The Department of Agriculture's budget fell under four primary principles in the governor's budget. These programs are very broad in their nature and execution, and therefore hit the environmental principle, the public safety principle, and the economic principle, as well as the health and basic needs principles. Now I'm on page 4. The Department of Administrative Services governor's recommended budget is $75.8 million total funds. That is broken down federal funds 7%, lottery funds 8%, general fund 24%, other funds 61%. The other funds portion is made up primarily of business licenses and fees and charges for services. Moving on to page 5. Stop me if you want. Food safety is the first program. It's 31% of the program. That program is funded about 80% other fund, general fund, 18% at this time. There is a small, very small portion of federal funds that was added for GRB, for governor's recommended budget, and that is in the area of bioterrorism. Natural resources program area is 45% of the agency of the agency's program expenditures. The funding mix on that is 26% general fund, 19% lottery funds, 42% other funds, and 13% federal funds. This is stuff that's not on your chart. I just added it figuring you might want to know it. So again, if you want me to go slower, let me know. Agriculture development program area is 14% of the total agency expenditures and is 29% general fund, 70% other fund, and a little under 1% federal lottery funds. And finally, the administration and support services program area is approximately 80% other funds, 20% general funds. Any questions before I move on? On page 6, we have the budget categories. Personal services makes up the largest portion of this agency's budget, 61%. There's 524 positions and 348.57 FTE. The big difference in that number is driven largely by the large number of seasonal positions the agency has, so they're on for relatively few months, which translates into smaller full-time equivalents. Services supplies is the next biggest area. It's roughly 30%. Capital outlay is a very small portion of this budget, and the remainder is 9% special payments.
And what are the special payments predominantly made up of?
The special payments are distributions to other governments, and by far the largest portion is for soil and water conservation districts, plus a few other programs I can list if you care to.
No?
Does that include monitoring who's taken what out of the stream, any of that? Do you help water resources with any of those water masters or any of that? That's not helping them at all. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Please proceed.
Okay. Page 7 is your historical chart that shows 99-01 actuals, 01-03 actuals, 03-05 approved, and governor's budget. You'll see some changes in the area of lottery and other funds. This is due primarily to, in the governor's budget, a reversal of some fund shifts that were done in the 03-05 biennium that were not repeated in 05-07. There was some reductions in positions and full-time equivalents, and those were largely driven by revenue issues, primarily in the food safety area, but also some areas in commodity inspection. Page 8, major policy issues. As the committee is aware, food safety program funding the balance between fees and general funds is a continuing issue. That balance was shifted somewhat in 03-05 and is something that needs to be resolved in 05-07 as well.
Representative Shocker.
The fee question, is that reflected in the 58.5%? Increase in the general fund part of the chart below. Does that include the fee increases that we're going to be discussing?
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffler, the agency proposed a policy package that included a general fund increase to fund food safety. It was not completely included in the governor's recommended budget. It was only partially included. So at this point in time, the food safety program is approximately $900,000 short of what is necessary to operate at current operational levels.
Okay. And may I please, and then how much was the pesticide use in the government's budget?
It was 1.4. Chair Morgan, Representative Shoffler, $1.4 million.
Thank you very much. So I get this squared away.
Representative Krieger.
They didn't want to find that money, did
they? I'm not trying to cause trouble, Madam Chair. Just got to get my math squared.
You're on the record.
Thank you.
Please move ahead.
Additionally, issues facing the agency are issues regarding Oregon agricultural competitiveness, changing markets and emphases, growth in population and issues such as homeland security, sudden oak death, and I'm going to try this, bovine spongiform and cephalophilophy.
Close.
Almost. BSC. Forevermore referred to as BSC, are increasing demands for ODA services. And the use of Measure 66 lottery funds and Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds, better known as PCSRF, are also issues that are in the air for this agency.
You know, this is probably a good time that I should warn Representative Shoffler that there's been a tradition established in the subcommittee that the newest minority member gets to carry all the bills with Latin terms in them.
That was Representative Johnson last time. She practiced for 2 weeks. Everywhere you saw her, she was walking down the hall saying it.
Carpe diem.
I did practice it back at the office, and it just wouldn't roll off. Okay. We're on page 9 now, with your indulgence. New investments in the governor's recommended budget for this biennium include funding for the Pesticide Analytic Response Center, Pesticide Use Reporting System, and Consumer Education Program. Those three components combined comprise that $1.4 million that I was referring to. Partial restoration of general fund support for food safety, and again, the agency requested more than what was provided in the governor's recommended budget. A food safety program fee increase to maintain current program operations. And let me stop and clarify here. The agency's request for fee increase at the governor's recommended budget presumed that a higher level of general fund would be available. So the fee increase is proposed.
$800,000 needs to be added back in.
Yes. If that is not provided, then the fee increase would need to be higher to maintain the program at its current levels. Correct. I want to make sure I'm clarifying, because what we did is there were two parts to that package, and the general fund part of it was reduced for governor's rec, but we did not offset that by increasing the fee any more than what the agency required. We just left it. additional new investments, food animal tracking system and a bioterrorism coordinator. The bioterrorism coordinator package is a federal funded program, and food animal tracking is also federally funded. Continuing on, sudden note death eradication and control. It's a new investment, and that is a combination of federal and other funds. And the governor's recommended budget restored general fund funding for a threatened and endangered plant program. And also, finally, added resources for agricultural development and certification programs. I apologize for my stumbling tongue today. Fee or revenue issues. As we've discussed, and I'll continue to bring this up, food safety, revenues, and funding in the governor's recommended budget are not adequate to maintain the program at its current operational levels, and the amount necessary, the difference there is $900,000. There is a fee increase included in the governor's budget, but as we discussed, it is not sufficient to offset that need. Several other fee increases are included in the governor's recommended budget. Many of these were authorized in the interim or were authorized by the last legislature and require your ratification. I'll go over them briefly. Virus fruit tree, fertilizer, agricultural amendment, and agricultural mineral inspection, livestock brand renewal, pesticide application dealer or consultant, and veterinary formulations. If you need additional information on those fees, we would certainly be happy to provide it. The agency also has requested a number of technical adjustments. We had a technical error in the calculations of a fund shift for the Insect Pest Prevention and Management Program, and we need to find $621,000 to fix that error.
I just love this kind of
The agency is requesting an increase in federal funds limitations to account for funds authorized by the April Emergency Board. It's not a person named April. It is the April Emergency Board. Basically, any emergency fund action that happened after April 2004 is not included in the agency's base budget request, and so this is an increase just to increase that limitation and commensurate with those actions. A small adjustment to decrease the lottery funds transfer in for county fairs, that's approximately $25,000. Adjustments in funding for pension bond obligations, that's an inter-program adjustment. It's not a significant dollar amount. And an increase in lottery fund expenditure limitations for weed board grants that are carried forward from the 2003-05 biennium to the 05-07 biennium. And with that, I have no further information unless you have questions.
Thank you very much. Let's move ahead.
Madam Chair.
Again,
Katie Koba, Director of Department of Agriculture. We would now like to go through, again, a quick overview of the agency's programs and as well as budget, and some of the information will be duplicative of what Christina provided, so we can move quickly through that. But we have agency overview, governor's recommended budget, program areas and key budget drivers, proposed option packages, cost containment efforts, and a summary of agency legislation. We had shared with you the mission for the agency in phase one. Real quickly again, it's to promote the economic viability of the industry, protect and enhance the natural resource base, and to provide consumer safety and protection. And in implementing that mission, we have key objectives, which in many cases are very similar to the mission statement. Help the agricultural industry to succeed economically. Help the agricultural industry to succeed environmentally. Respond to plant and animal pests, diseases, and other threats. And ensure safe food and protect Oregon's consumers. Here is picture of our organizational chart. It can look a bit busy, but we basically have myself as director, Chuck Craig as our deputy, two assistant directors, Lisa Hansen and Dalton Hobbs, and then our respective divisions in the agency. You saw this in a little different format from Christina. Basically, the top row is the 03-05 legislatively adopted budget, and you can see then broken down the percentages by fund source for 03-05. And then the third row is the 2005-07 governor's recommended budget, so you can see the differences between 03-05 leg adopted and 05-07 proposed by the governor. And we'll get into the more details later in terms of where some of those dollars are coming from. Again, this is a repeat of Christina's chart. We're predominantly another funds agency from fees and services. Then in the proposed budget, 24% general fund, 8% lottery fund, 7% federal funds. Oops. Here's another graphic in terms of what's happened to our agency budget over time. We have the 2001-03 actual budget. The bottom lavender is general fund, and then purple is lottery fund, other funds in the yellow, and federal funds in white or light blue or whatever color. You can compare that across to the 03-05 legislatively approved budget and then the 05-07 governor's recommended budget. Fairly steady. Not any huge changes in terms of funding composition. We have three primary policy areas in the agency and then divisions that fall within those policy areas. So, again, as Christina showed, the natural resources policy area is the largest in terms of funding, and that contains four divisions, and we'll get into those divisions and their programs. Followed by food safety and consumer protection at 31% of the agency's budget, our agricultural development policy area at 14% of the budget, and then our administration and support services at 10%. And then you can see another breakdown, and this is indeed by division. So you can see that the plant division is the largest division in terms of resources, 20%, followed by natural resources, and then our other divisions. So now I'd like to go through each policy area and talk you through the divisions that are within those policy areas and then the programs that are within those divisions. So you can have a clear understanding of what the agency does. Diversity is the best way to describe our agency. In the economic development policy area, we have two divisions. The first division that I'd like to talk about is the Ag Development and Marketing Division. And within that division, we conduct market development, technical assistance, and trade promotion in both the domestic and the international markets. We have a position that works with the industry to help it succeed, and that includes developing and helping existing businesses expand, and working to recruit new ag food processing businesses to the state. Our Commodity Commission Oversight Program is within this division, where we oversee the state's 29 commodity commissions. We do work with direct marketing assistance, helping and supporting farmers markets, roadside stands, and other opportunities for direct marketing. Another success story that we've had this biennium under direct marketing is the efforts with Brand Oregon, both with our seafood commodity commissions as well as the Oregon Bounty Program, which was a wine, cheese, hazelnuts, and pear promotion last fall, and the industry is excited about doing that again and expanding that program. We have our farm mediation and supervised price negotiations between annual perennial ryegrass and the seafood area, and the annual ryegrass growers are having conversations about having supervised price negotiations. Question? Pardon?
That's similar to what we did with the seafood thing a couple years ago.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, yes.
Madam Chair, just a minute. You're talking about the commodity commissions, and a session or two ago, we passed legislation that did something I can't remember. There was some problems with the blueberry people or something I can't remember.
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, last session, I believe it was Senate Bill 854, was a bill that actually applied to all commodity commissions to deal with the growing number of court cases questioning whether commodity commissions were truly a government agency and whether you could assess people and whether that qualified for government speech. So we basically had a rewrite of the Commodity Commission law to, in essence, have them act more like government agencies so that if there were indeed a court case brought against our Commodity Commission programs that we would hold up in court. There is a case pending in the U.S. Supreme Court dealing with the U.S. beef checkoff program, and we're awaiting the outcome of that case. It could have implications for a Commodity Commission program.
I support your efforts here, but I wanted to know, is there anything dollar for dollar benefit you can show us for our investment? We put X in and we get what out? Is there anything like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, we do keep track of sales of agricultural products where we have provided assistance, as well as one of our new performance measures that you've seen is we're going to try to attract investment in the state or expansion in the state as a result of the efforts that we are involved in with the industry. We could certainly go back and provide you some information that we have currently.
And then, thank you, Madam Chair, that, and then the lab up in Portland, I forget what it's called, that's part of this too, right? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, we have an export service center, which is part of our laboratory function that can pre-certify products moving into the export market based on foreign country standards, so that they're not then have to be retested once they hit those borders. The Ag Development and Marketing Division is co-located at the Portland Food Innovation Center with Oregon State University.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk to the committee about how the commodity commissions are funded?
Madam Chair, the commodity commissions are funded by an assessment on their product. And I may have to have Dalton come up and clarify if I move astray, but wheat commission, for example, wheat producers pay an assessment on all wheat produced in the state that goes to the wheat commission. So there are no general funds in those commodity commissions, but it's a self-assessment.
A little bit on a bushel, 3 cents a bushel. Is that what it's 3 cents a bushel?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, apparently it's 2 cents a bushel.
I haven't paid too much.
Thank you for your contribution to the health of the agricultural industry.
I know, I'm just trying to help out.
The state of Oregon's eternally grateful.
So the point that I wanted to make is that there is no general fund in the commodity commissions, and so it's kind of a way for the people that are involved in that particular economy to participate in a group situation that allows them to be more effective as a group than as individuals.
And then we're constantly trying to help the industry identify financial resources and assist growers and companies to access those at the state level. You know, it could be programs within the Economic and Community Development Department for business expansion or business recruitment, and we work very closely with that agency in those efforts.
The program that uses USDA dollars to reimburse people for buying things at farmers markets and fresh produce and things like that, how is that program doing?
Madam Chair, there's a couple of programs, the Women and Infant Children Coupon Program and also a Senior Nutrition Program. Senior program, if I remember correctly, is performing very well. I think Oregon has one of the highest performance rates in the United States, which is obviously a benefit to our seniors as well as to producers who bring product to farmers markets.
That's a very popular program, and people, seniors, are always talking to me about it. And I know that when you were first starting the program, it took a while to get people registered into it. Has that part of the issue been overcome at this point?
I believe there is still an issue with basically it's the technology that's available at farmers markets and being able to. I'm going to have Dalton come up, Madam Chair. I can tell if I'm not answering it correctly. If Dalton, if you could come up and answer that question.
Just scoot over here. Excuse me.
Quickly, for the record, I'm Dalton Hobbs, Assistant Director, Oregon Department of Agriculture. The senior nutrition program, indeed, has been a true success story. Oregon has, I believe, the highest redemption rate of coupons. We're well over 90% of the coupons. This year, we received a little bit less than $800,000. So that means that close to $800,000 goes directly into the farm economy. This year, for this coming season, the program has changed so that instead of an actual paper coupon, there is a small check, or the equivalent of a check. And so we've been working very closely with the Oregon Bankers Association to ensure that these checks are indeed redeemable and cashable, and so it doesn't cost the vendor more money to run them through their account than the $1 or $2 check that's the face amount on the check. But it has truly been a very successful program for us.
So instead of the coupons, which you needed to bring back in and then reimburse the vendors for, does the checks, the vendors are cleared through a bank account?
Madam Chair, that's correct. These are actual negotiable instruments that would be deposited into the seller's bank account. Instead of a coupon. And the coupon had its own set of problems in terms of accounting and in terms of going back and forth between the vendors and the Department of Human Services.
So does that lessen down within the Department of Ag the clerical work that would go on in relation to the program?
Madam Chair, the actual fiscal or financial side is handled by DHS, and this is a very close cooperative program. Our role in this is to enroll the vendors and to provide publicity as well as education about the markets themselves, and so we work very closely with DHS on this program.
Representative Krieger had a question.
Do you know what the qualifications are for seniors? Is it poverty level or income or age or what is it?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, there is a means test. I don't have it in front of me, but it is, I believe it's 120% of poverty level or below, and I think there's an age requirement on it. I can get the exact parameters for you, though.
$1,283 a month, and my age 65 will qualify.
Yep. You can get all the cucumbers you like.
And in terms of the vendors enrolling, what's the process there?
The vendors, Madam Chair, the vendors enroll through the Oregon Department of Agriculture through our offices in Portland. I believe we are up 50% over this time last year in terms of participant vendors. It's been an extremely popular program with not only vendors who work at farmers markets, but also roadside stands, direct farm stands can participate as well. So you don't necessarily have to go into the farmers market. If you have a roadside stand, you can participate there. So they call us up, we send them out the materials and get them signed up, and they're good to go.
Is there access to that on your website anywhere?
Madam Chair, yes, there is.
Thank you. Please proceed.
This next slide identifies what we believe are key budget drivers, issues, and environmental factors related to our division's program. First of all is the diversity of our industry. We're not a Midwest producing state where we worry about four or five commodities. When you're dealing with over 220 commodities, lots of diverse issues raised with our industry's diversity. Certainly critical infrastructure issues in terms of wastewater treatment costs for food processors. Fewer food processors in the state of Oregon. We're watching that very closely and frankly a little bit concerned about the implications for our industry. The fact that we are distant from major markets, the nursery industry, for example, their major market is the East Coast, and being able to get enough trucks to ship product to the East Coast is a huge challenge for them. A big issue in this
crisis must be an issue right now.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. A big issue in this program, as well as frankly in all the programs in our agency, is the globalization of trade, how we remain competitive in a global market, how we can continue to compete with labor costs that tend to be higher than some of our competitors in other countries, again, being able to move product and some of the transportation costs associated with that. And other programs, our plant program, for example, the importing of pests and diseases and implications on our industry. Obviously, the importance of export markets, 80% of what we produce leaves our state borders. Over 40% of that moves into international markets. Marketing is very, very important for this industry, and certainly both the domestic and the international market. Changing consumer preferences. We've gone from the Atkins diet now to the latest, you know, we want everything, all the foods that have all the nutritional stuff in there and anything that's enhanced that we can get our hands on. So that's kind of the latest wave in terms of consumer preferences. But certainly minority populations, which are now a majority in the 30 largest U.S. cities, and the food that these folks eat, and being aware of that, and frankly marketing your product to these consumer preferences. And renewable energy opportunities. Representative Dingfelder is an expert on that. We're very involved, not only with the biofuels effort, but wind energy, microhydro opportunities with small-scale irrigation facilities, anaerobic digesters on animal feeding operations, and those kinds of opportunities, which we think would be very beneficial for our industry.
The biofuels issue is one that there's a great deal of interest in this session around. Can you just very quickly and at a very high level give the committee the kind of an overview of the issues that ODA is working in relation to this?
Madam Chair, we actually have a package, one of the packages that we'll speak to, that is asking for a position to be kind of our renewable energy coordinator within the agency. We've relied on Brent Searle, Special Assistant to the Director, to pick up those efforts. And it's not just in biofuels, but it's really outreach to the agricultural community to inform them and educate them in terms of what are the possibilities that are available. And if they are indeed interested in wind generation, hooking them up with individuals that have the expertise to do that, you know, really kind of planting the seed about the opportunities that are there, and then bringing the resources to bear to develop that. With biofuels, biodiesel in particular, we are entering into a conversation around this issue of canola production in the state, and some of the concerns by specialty seed producers about cross-contamination with canola and cauliflower, broccoli, what have you. So we'll be looking at our control district authority to perhaps set boundaries in terms of where you can and cannot produce canola to try to minimize any potential negative impacts. There's just a lot going on in this area, and it's a place where we think the industry can really have some economic opportunity. With that, the second division within the economic development policy area is our commodity inspection division. And this is the programs within this division include our inspection programs, where we provide quality assurance to Oregon producers, packers, and shippers through official sampling, grading, inspection, and verification to meet market demand. So, you know, we go out and grade cherries that they're certain size, certain quality. And in this area, we are seeing change in terms of what kind of service we provide, moving more to, as opposed to standing on the end of the line and looking at every single item that comes along, moving more to a process verification or an audit function to keep costs down for producers. The second area that we're very, very aware of is this notion of certification. We provide certification services now within our commodity inspection division with good agricultural practices and good handling practices programs in particular. We also have seed regulatory programs and the hops, hay, and grain certification program. But again, we have a package that we'll be talking about in a little bit in terms of certification and the explosion of certification and various kinds of certification programs that we're seeing in the marketplace. And we believe we need to really step up and provide, be able to provide more technical assistance to the industry to take advantage of this market trend. In terms of key issues for our commodity inspection program, again, as I mentioned, the demand for alternative inspection services that are audit-based It's truly a cost control issue. Maintaining an adequate pool of qualified inspectors has been at times a challenge for us. You'll see...
Katie, can we back up for a second?
Absolutely.
The inspection services that are audit-based, mm-hmm. what exactly is that?
That's when I get back to, instead of standing on the line and watching every cherry that moves by, placing more of the quality grading kinds of process requirements on the producer themselves, we help them set up the process, and then we might come to the pallet at the end and make sure that indeed the things that they've plugged in to be quality X are indeed meet quality X. So we're performing more of an audit overview process setup verification than actually inspecting each individual item. Did I do that right? I know what I'm talking about. You'll see a little later, one of the interesting things we've done with cost containment is we set up a trial program using inmate labor in our commodity inspection program, and that's been a big success. So we may need to take advantage of more of that as we deal with this second issue for us.
More inmates?
We're not, Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, we're not making inmates. We're putting them to work.
I'm going to give you some.
Thank you. I've never been a big fan of inmate labor. That being said, are there some of these folks that are learning this and then going out and getting a job when they get out? That would be really good to hear.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I think that is certainly an opportunity for them. We just used this program for the first time this year, so we haven't been in it long enough to see an inmate that actually gets out and is able then to take advantage of these skills.
Joke now?
No, I'm not. I promise. This is a real question. It's really broad, too, but all this stuff going on, the certification and all this, our diversity and I know the Japanese had problems with their beef after that big scare, but with all this going on, I can't believe we're not ahead of the rest of the world on this stuff, especially if people are becoming more conscientious. Imagine the Europeans and everybody is. So globally, technically, we must be ahead, yet we're still struggling. Is it strictly due to the cost of producing in America that's keeping us back, or is it something else?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, you're referring to us being ahead in
technology? What we're doing here in Oregon and the United States?
Madam Chair, I would say that the United States on a whole does very well in terms of technology development, investment in research. Typically, that's not happening in Oregon, and it's not happening enough, I think, in Oregon for our natural resources-based industries. We've seen cuts in support there. Some of the Midwest universities are doing some amazing research and technology development. But you look at the flip side of that, we have a lot of food processing equipment that comes from Europe, is built there, and some cutting-edge stuff that comes out of Europe. In terms of certification, the leading markets for that tend to be Europe and Asia. And the state of Oregon, when we talk about Europe Gap, which is one kind of a certification program that originated in Europe, the state of Oregon is the only state that's actually a member of Europe Gap and still in the process in terms of trying to become allowed to be a certifying body for Europe Gap. But we tend on the market side to be pretty ahead of the trend in the U.S. here in Oregon.
That's good to hear. But so due to our lack of investment in going forward with this stuff, that's what's keeping us behind?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, the industry does an amazing job at staying competitive. We're actually doing well in the industry.
The state.
I would say in terms of the state and its commitments, that's not where you're going to find much of the innovation. Oregon State does an amazing job with the resources that it has. If they got a new infusion, they could do that much more. But I would say that Oregon State University was identified as one of the five regional centers by the U.S. government for Sun Grant Initiative. So in terms of, again, renewable energy opportunities and research, we've got a benefit there. So, again, speaking specifically in terms of certification, traceability, able to trace food and where it's come from, keeping products identity preserved through the whole food system. We're also very involved in that, and we'll be talking a little bit later in terms of one of our package requests to keep us on the cutting edge of those issues. I'd like to move now to our Food Safety and Consumer Protection Program. And we have four divisions within this policy area. The first division that I'll talk about is our Food Safety Division, and that's probably going to get us pretty close to the end of the day today. Our Food Safety Program is a skilled team of field inspectors and sanitarians that license and inspect all facets of the food processing, storage, and distribution system with the exception of restaurants. Restaurants are done by the Health Division. And this program does indeed ensure consumers that food is safe for consumption. The Food Safety Program is our agency's first point of response for food recalls and cases of foodborne illness. And within that division, we have our food program, our dairy program, and our shellfish program.
Katie, within the food program, I'm curious about how you draw the line on what's a restaurant and what's not a restaurant. You go into gas stations and they have like a heat lamp deli and some tables. Where's the line here?
Madam Chair, I'll take a stab at that, and I'm sure my staff will throw something at me if I get it wrong. It's based on the value of sales. So if the institution's sales has more than 50% that comes from food, deli type, then that is considered a restaurant and done by the Health Division. If it's less than that, less than 50%, then we do it.
You have a breakout for lottery sales in there?
Madam Chair, lottery tickets are not food. Key issues in our food safety program. Obviously, we've talked about it, and we'll talk about more, the whole funding issue for the program to both fund the staff and meet inspection needs of our food system. The complexity of inspections, you know, when you go to a Safeway now and you look at the deli, it's changed considerably from what it looked like 2, 3, 5 years ago, and what we need to look at and respond to make sure that food remains safe. Temperature is a big issue with food, and more food that's prepared and out, how you keep the hot things hot and the cold things cold throughout the days is one of the big issues that we work on. Again, as well, changing inspection protocols, moving to, you know, the HACCP-based inspections where we're really focusing in on and targeting risk-based things. Give an example, we used to go in and if paint was peeling on the walls, that would be an issue. But in essence, that doesn't really cause the potential for foodborne illnesses. It's some of these other things. So identifying those true risk factors and focusing on those in our inspections.
Is the main risk factor temperature?
We'll have Ron McKay, our division administrator, come up real quickly. Food safety is a fascinating area. Mm-hmm. After you listen to him, you don't want to go eat.
Well, I think in terms of public health issues, too, you could hardly find one that was more far-reaching than this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Ron McKay, the administrator of the Food Safety Division at the Department of Agriculture. We've identified a number of risk factors that we measure on our inspections. This was done by CDC. They have identified 10 risk factors that are most likely to cause foodborne illness, and we monitor those in all of our inspections, part of our routine inspection every time we go in an establishment.
What are they?
I can name all 10 of them right now. Certainly, there's temperature controls, personnel practices, source of food, training of individuals. I would be happy to bring you a full list of all of those.
I'd be interested in knowing what the main risk factors are. So if you could bring that, it would even be good to introduce it to the committee for the third stage of the deliberations. Thank you.
One of the challenges that we have in this program with the increasing cultural diversity of Oregon's population, both in terms of language and culture, being able to communicate the importance of safe food practices, And getting across some of those cultural barriers where they view food safety perhaps a little differently than we do. Globalization of the food supply and the emergence of virulent new microbes. This would be, you know, we all know about salmonella in food, and salmonella can cause sicknesses, but there are new little things growing out there that are not good for food. I think one example that I don't think is necessarily transmitted through food, but an example of a new kind of microbe would be the Norwalk virus, that, you know, known on cruise ships and things like that. And then we're very involved in homeland security issues and dealing with, hopefully never having to deal with, a terrorist attack using a foodborne method.
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. Are you all, I'm sure it's in here somewhere, so forgive me for not reading it, getting money from the federal government for that right there? Because who was it in here yesterday?
AEQ, I can't remember now. They had $600,000.
For something going to train firefighters.
We do have one person on staff in our food safety program. He's been on board for
6 months
or so. Federal fund that is our point person on dealing with homeland security issues, making sure we've got protocols in place, training for our staff in terms of response, those kinds of things. Now I'm going to dive into the funding issue with food safety and hopefully explain this in a way that makes sense to you.
15 minutes.
Yep. The food safety division's license fees, the current fee structure has been in place since 1987. And this is set, we have a cap in statute, and then within administrative rules we actually set the specific levels that various establishments pay based on their gross sales.
So just to clarify then, the fee structure has been in place since 1987. Have the fees remained the same, or have you moved them up under the cap?
Madam Chair, the fees have remained the same since 1987. And the division has historically been funded with a combination of general fund and other funds. In 2001, the Food Safety Division had a fund balance of about $5.9 million. And just to put that in context, we're predicting that the total resource needed to fund the program, and this may not be exactly apples to apples, is $9.8 million for 2005-2007. The balance, so it was a fairly healthy imbalance.
The 9.8 just funds the program. It doesn't fund any reserves.
It funds about a three-month level of reserves.
Okay.
We figure 9.6 funds the program, and then that would provide $200,000 to $300,000 in reserves. So the balance in 2001 was a result of the strong economy during the 90s, an increase in the number of licensed facilities, as well as strong interest earnings. Beginning in the 2002 special session and looking for resources to fill the budget hole, as well as the 2003 regular session, the legislature shifted a significant portion of our general fund out of the Food Safety Division and asked us to use our other funds and use our other funds ending balance to fund the program. A total of about $1.4 million of general fund was removed out of the program. This current biennium, we have little $450,000, I believe, in general fund in the program. So basically a drop of nearly $2 million in general fund down to the $400,000 or so we have now.
So the total funding in the program right now is
$415,000. Madam Chair, $428,000 for 2003-2005 in general fund. Prior to 2002...
Can I ask one more clarification question?
So
$428,000, is that what will be in the fund at the end of this fiscal biennium?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. The $428,000 is the amount of general fund that was appropriated for the 2003-2005 biennium for the program. The remainder of it is funded with other funds this current biennium.
Okay.
going into this biennium, we were concerned about being able to make it through the biennium with an ending fund balance. I'll talk in a minute about the cost containment efforts we put in place, and we actually will have an ending fund balance.
I'll just zip and listen.
So prior to 2002, the general fund support in the program was at about 30% to 70% fees. In this current biennium, that $428,000 represents 5% of the funding for the program. 5% is general fund, the remainder, 95%, is now fee supported. So we have shifted out general fund, ate down our ending balance, so now we are in a position of needing to basically double license fees to keep the program going at its current operating level unless there is an infusion of additional general fund back into the program.
That's if we went by the governor's recommended.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The governor's recommended budget is about $1.2 million in general fund and would require significant fee increase.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I've heard about from my constituents, small business, I'm sure you have too, and I know it's not your job to go out and round up, but hopefully some of the representatives are listening to us here. Fee increases, everybody's really sensitive. One of the I've been very selective this year personally. I'm not speaking for any of my colleagues here, but one of the things that has helped me justify it is getting some support from the industry. In this case, I'm not talking about the huge, big folks you're inspecting. I'm talking about the mom and pop folks that may not come say to me and say, yes, I support this fee increase, but at least say, this is better than it was at the beginning of the session. So somehow I want to get to that. I had a couple in there. They've been in business for 20 years at 82nd Playbell, and they said there was going to be a 400% increase in their inspection fee. I don't know if any of that's true. From what I saw your scale, that isn't true. And I haven't heard back from them since you all sent that letter out. But I'm still they're probably still concerned about maybe where they're at in sales relative to Fred Meyer's. Why should I pay with Fred? You see where I'm going with all this? So somehow I'd like to
Madam Chair,
support out there in the community for what we're doing would help me a lot.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, the governor's recommended budget does reinvest general fund into the program. It still requires a significant fee increase, and we submitted legislation that basically takes the current fee structure that's in statute, raises the caps, and then the fees would increase to fund the program. There is another proposal on the table, which I'm sure you've heard about, and I know the industry will be in here next Tuesday to share that with you, which also represents a fee increase. They're looking for more general fund than that is in the governor's recommended budget, and they change the basis on which fees are established. Ours, as I said, is gross sales, so it's based on the size of the establishment. They do a combination of both sales as well as the amount of time that it takes us in the various establishments. So that represents a shifting in fees in their proposal from where we are currently.
There's a lot of moving parts here.
Yes, I understand.
And that's the challenge, trying to explain it in a way that makes sense.
Thank you.
Let me go through the cost containment efforts that we put in place this current biennium so that we could get through this biennium without having to raise fees. We have held inspector positions vacant. We've held three inspector positions vacant through the course of the biennium. We made that clear up front that we did not believe this was a permanent solution to our funding shortage. We've had other individuals that have retired, and so we've had some positions vacant longer than the three full-time FTE, but certainly the three were held vacant through the course of the whole biennium. We have reduced sampling and testing levels to the minimum as required by the FDA programs. We have eliminated sampling and testing of retail ready-to-eat foods. We have reduced the number of pesticide residue tests that we require by 50%, and these tests are now being performed by FDA, so that's a free service to us. They don't charge us to run those tests. If we did it within our own lab, that would be a cost.
This checks the pesticide residue on fruits and vegetables.
I'm sure that's correct. We have put in place lab efficiency measures and streamlining that has reduced testing costs in our lab. And we have eliminated investigations of economic fraud, such as milk fat content of ice cream, where there is no food safety issue. So you are now on your own to guarantee that the milk fat content on the label is indeed.
We have such discerning consumers of ice cream in the state.
You can just taste it, right?
Notice if things change. Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you. I have a question about labeling, Katie, because and there was it the front page of the paper today about labeling laws. Can you just explain a little bit about the nexus between what the work you do in sampling and checking on labeling laws? That and I know that there's some new labeling laws coming down from the federal level, and will you be receiving any additional federal funding for monitoring sampling of those labels?
Okay. Again, Ron McKay with Food Safety Division. Madam Chair, Representative Dingfelder, as part of every one of our 750 FDA contract inspections, we do a label review. We collect samples of labels, submit those to FDA. So that part of the work will continue. We do some label work on most of our inspections when we're in retail stores. We are observant for any deficiencies that are there. That would include label reviews. When a new establishment starts up, that is part of the initial inspection, is a label review to assure that their product is correct when it goes on the marketplace. Some of the large firms have very technical staff and can do this quite well. Some of the smaller businesses don't.
Follow up to that. So do you provide them with technical assistance? I don't know if you read the New York Times last Sunday, but there was a very comical story about how wild farm-raised salmon were being labeled as wild farm-raised from Canada, which I'm scratching my head. But so I mean, do you provide any type of technical assistance to folks about what exactly they're labeling?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Dingfelder, yes, that is part of the work that we do, education, working with them on the various types of issues. If we don't have answers, we will try and put them in contact with people who do have answers. So,
Representative Shaw.
Thank you. And I just want to clarify my line of questioning, especially after hearing this. If you have vacant positions and you're doing minimum work, that means something is not getting done. And I'm very interested and concerned in filling those positions, making that whole. I mean, my little baby's out there eating food, too. So I don't want you to think. I don't want you all weekend thinking that Schaufler. That's definitely not my line of questioning there. I just wanted to clarify that.
We're right on the button time-wise here. I'm still looking for the ending balance that you'll have at the end of the biennium.
Madam Chair, we are estimating ending balance to be at $800,000, roughly. And I just have two more slides, and then we'll be done with food safety.
Okay.
They're pretty quick,
I believe.
We'll
take a run for it.
So as I've mentioned, our legislation proposes moving the fee cap from $750 to $1,500. The amount of general fund in the governor's recommended budget would still require us to almost double license fees to fully fund the program. We're estimating 9.6 million total funds to fund the program. That's assuming no ending balance. And there you can see the governor's recommended budget, $1 million in general fund, roughly $1 million. So the 1.2 million I said was a mistake, a little over $1 million. In the governor's budget, 5.7 million in other funds, which is fees. And as Christina mentioned, that does not include the $979,000 that we are short in the governor's budget. So in essence, we need the $1 million plus in general fund, the 5.7 in other funds, and the $979,000 to all add up to, I believe, $9.8 million that funds the program and provides a bit of an ending balance.
So this program essentially needs $1 million. if the world was to unfold perfectly, which doesn't happen very often.
In my world.
Okay. And even given that $980 million infusion of general fund, does that mean then that the program will still need 85 to 90% fund increase?
And I'm sure that's correct.
Thank you.
The last slide just represents what gets cut off as you cut off people. So, Representative Schaffler, this is a good slide for you to review. It starts with the staff level at 41.
I don't wear them around here yet.
and then as you reduce staff, what the implications are to the program.
Thank you.
With the reduced level of staffing and inspections that have been in place now, have you seen an increase in foodborne problems, diseases?
Madam Chair, the illness reports go into the State Health Division, who are monitoring those, and the communications we've had with them is no, we're not seeing an increase in illness reports. At this time, what our staff is doing is faster inspections, not as detailed, not as thorough. We're trying to keep up with the workload and making every attempt to do that, but we're not seeing an increase in illness reports.
And from my perspective, Madam Chair, that's kind of a stopgap measure. I mean, you can only push down the gas pedal so hard for so long. And if we were looking at permanent reductions in staff, it would be a change in the way we do business. That's it for today.
Is this a good place to break?
This is a perfect place to break.
Okay. What I'll do then is close the public hearing on House Bills 5003 and 04. And do you have any announcements for us, Mr. Seeger?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Monday, first thing we will do is the DEQ grant that we discussed yesterday. I passed out to your offices yesterday a copy of the LFO analysis and the request letter from the department.
So we will see you Monday, same time, same station, and with that, this meeting is adjourned.